He made himself Archbishop of Canterbury, for his greater glory, and exercised such power over the neighbouring British princes, and so collected them about the king, that once, when the king held his court at Chester, and went on the River Dee to visit the monastery of St. John, the 8 oars of his boat were pulled, as the people used to delight in relating in stories and songs, by 8 crowned kings, and steered by the King of England. As Edgar was very obedient to Dunstan and the monks, they took great pains to represent him as the best of kings. But he was really profligate, debauched, and vicious. He once forcibly carried off a young lady from the convent at Wilton, and Dunstan, pretending to be very much shocked, condemned him not to wear his crown upon his head for 7 years, and no great punishment, I dare say, as it can hardly have been a more comfortable ornament to wear than a stewpan without a handle. His marriage with his second wife, Elfrida, is one of the worst events of his reign. Hearing of the beauty of this lady, he dispatched his favourite courtier, Athwold, to her father at EMS Castle in Devonshire, to see if she were really as charming as fame reported. Now, she was so exceedingly beautiful that Athelwold fell in love with her himself, and married her, but he told the king that she was only rich and not handsome. The king, suspecting the truth when they came home, resolved to pay the newly married couple a visit, and, suddenly, told Athelwold to prepare for his immediate coming. Athelwold, terrified, confessed to his young wife what he had said and done, and implored her to disguise her beauty by some ugly dress or silly manner, that he might be safe from the king of TMS anger. She promised that she would, but she was a proud woman, who would far rather have been a queen than the wife of a courtier. She dressed herself in her best dress, and adorned herself with her richest jewels, and when the king came, presently, he discovered the cheat. So, he caused his false friend, Athelwold, to be murdered in a wood, and married his widow, this bad Elfrida. 6 or 7 years afterwards, he died, and was buried, as if he had been all that the monks said he was, in the Abbey of Glastonbury, which he or Dunstan for Hema had much enriched. England, in one part of this reign, was so troubled by wolves, which, driven out of the open country, hid themselves in the mountains of Wales when they were not attacking travellers and animals, that the tribute payable by the Welsh people was forgiven them, on condition of their producing, every year, 300 wolves at TM heads. And the Welshmen were so sharp upon the wolves, to save their money, that in 4 years there was not a wolf left. Then came the boy king, Edward, called the Martyr, from the manner of his death. Elfrida had a son, named Ethelred, for whom she claimed the throne, but Dunstan did not choose to favour him, and he made Edward king. The boy was hunting, one day, down in Dorsetshire, when he rode near to Calfe Castle, where Elfrida and Ethelred lived. Wishing to see them kindly, he rode away from his attendants and galloped to the castle gate, where he arrived at twilight, and blew his hunting horn. "You are welcome, dear king, ATM," said Elfrida, coming out, with her brightest smiles. "I pray you dismount and enter. ATM, not so, dear madam, ATM," said the king. "My company will miss me, and fear that I have met with some harm. Please you to give me a cup of wine, that I may drink here, in the saddle, to you and to my little brother, and so ride away with the good speed I have made in riding here." ATM Elfrida, going in to bring the wine, whispered an armed servant, one of her attendants, who stole out of the darkening gateway, and crept round behind the king of TMS horse. As the king raised the cup to his lips, saying, "A health, ATM to the wicked woman who was smiling on him, and to his innocent brother whose hand she held in hers, and who was only 10 years old," this armed man made a spring and stabbed him in the back. He dropped the cup and spurred his horse away, but, soon fainting with loss of blood, dropped from the saddle, and, in his fall, entangled one of his feet in the stirrup. The frightened horse dashed on, trailing his rider at EMS curls upon the ground, dragging his smooth young face through ruts, and stones, and briars, and fallen leaves, and mud, until the hunters, tracking the animal at TMS course by the king of TMS blood, caught his bridle, and released the disfigured body. Then came the sixth and last of the boy kings, Aethelred, whom Elfrida, when he cried out at the sight of his murdered brother riding away from the castle gate, unmercifully beat with a torch which she snatched from one of the attendants. The people so disliked this boy, on account of his cruel mother and the murder she had done to promote him, that Dunstan would not have had him for king, but would have made Aegitha, the daughter of the dead King Edgar, and of the lady whom he stole out of the convent at Wilton, Queen of England, if she would have consented. But she knew the stories of the youthful kings too well, and would not be persuaded from the convent where she lived in peace, so, Dunstan put Aethelred on the throne, having no one else to put there, and gave him the nickname of the Unregian, knowing that he wanted resolution and firmness. At first, Elfrida possessed great influence over the young king, but, as he grew older and came of age, her influence declined. The infamous woman, not having it in her power to do any more evil, then retired from court, and, according to the fashion of the time, built churches and monasteries, to expiate her guilt. As if a church, with a steeple reaching to the very stars, would have been any sign of true repentance for the blood of the poor boy, whose murdered form was trailed at his horsey TMS heels. As if she could have buried her wickedness beneath the senseless stones of the whole world, piled up one upon another, for the monks to live in. About the ninth or tenth year of this reign, Dunstan died. He was growing old then, but was as stern and artful as ever. Two circumstances that happened in connection with him, in this reign of Aethelred, made a great noise. Once, he was present at a meeting of the church, when the question was discussed whether priests should have permission to marry, and, as he sat with his head hung down, apparently thinking about it, a voice seemed to come out of a crucifix in the room, and warn the meeting to be of his opinion. This was some juggling of Dunstan at TMS, and was probably his own voice disguised. But he played off a worse juggle than that, soon afterwards, for, another meeting being held on the same subject, and he and his supporters being seated on one side of a great room, and their opponents on the other, he rose and said, "A to Christ himself, as judge, do I commit this cause." ATM immediately on these words being spoken, the floor where the opposite party sat gave way, and some were killed and many wounded. You may be pretty sure that it had been weakened under Dunstan at TMS direction, and that it fell at Dunstan at TMS signal. His part of the floor did not go down. No, no. He was too good a workman for that. When he died, the monks settled that he was a saint, and called him Saint Dunstan ever afterwards. They might just as well have settled that he was a coach horse, and could just as easily have called him one. Aethelred the Unready was glad enough, I dare say, to be rid of this holy saint, but, left to himself, he was a poor weak king, and his reign was a reign of defeat and shame. The restless Danes, led by Sweyn, a son of the King of Denmark who had quarrelled with his father and had been banished from home, again came into England, and, year after year, attacked and despoiled large towns. To coax these sea kings away, the weak Aethelred paid them money, but, the more money he paid, the more money the Danes wanted. At first, he gave them £10,000, on their next invasion, £16,000, on their next invasion, £4,000, to pay which large sums. The unfortunate English people were heavily taxed. But, as the Danes still came back and wanted more, he thought it would be a good plan to marry into some powerful foreign family that would help him with soldiers. So, in the year 1002, he courted and married Emma, the sister of Richard Duke of Normandy, a lady who was called the Flower of Normandy. And now, a terrible deed was done in England, the like of which was never done on English ground before or since. On the 13th of November, in pursuance of secret instructions sent by the king over the whole country, the inhabitants of every town and city armed, and murdered all the Danes who were their neighbours. Young and old, babies and soldiers, men and women, Every Dane was killed. No doubt there were among them many ferocious men who had done the English great wrong, and whose pride and insolence, in swaggering in the houses of the English and insulting their wives and daughters, had become unbearable. But no doubt there were also among them many peaceful Christian Danes who had married English women and become like English men. They were all slain, even to Gunhilda, the sister of the King of Denmark, married to an English lord, who was first obliged to see the murder of her husband and her child, and then was killed herself. When the King of the Sea Kings heard of this deed of blood, he swore that he would have a great revenge. He raised an army, and a mightier fleet of ships than ever yet had sailed to England, and in all his army there was not a slave or an old man, but every soldier was a free man, and the son of a free man, and in the prime of life, and sworn to be revenged upon the English nation, for the massacre of that dread 13th of November, when his countrymen and countrywomen, and the little children whom they loved, were killed with fire and sword. And so, the Sea Kings came to England in many great ships, each bearing the flag of its own commander. Golden eagles, ravens, dragons, dolphins, beasts of prey, threatened England from the prows of those ships, as they came onward through the water, and were reflected in the shining shields that hung upon their sides. The ship that bore the standard of the King of the Sea Kings was carved and painted like a mighty serpent, and the king in his anger prayed that the gods in whom he trusted might all desert him, if his serpent did not strike its fangs into England at Tiamat's heart. And indeed it did. For, the great army landing from the great fleet, near Exeter, went forward, laying England waste, and striking their lances in the earth as they advanced, or throwing them into rivers, in token of their making all the island theirs. In remembrance of the Black November night when the Danes were murdered, wheresoever the invaders came, they made the Saxons prepare and spread for them great feasts, and when they had eaten those feasts, and had drunk a curse to England with wild rejoicings, they drew their swords, and killed their Saxon entertainers, and marched on. For 6 long years they carried on this war, burning the crops, farmhouses, barns, mills, granaries, killing the laborers in the fields, preventing the seed from being sown in the ground, causing famine and starvation, leaving only heaps of ruin and smoking ashes, where they had found rich towns. To crown this misery, English officers and men deserted, and even the favorites of Ethelred the Unready, becoming traitors, seized many of the English ships, turned pirates against their own country, and aided by a storm occasioned the loss of nearly the whole English navy. There was but one man of note, at this miserable pass, who was true to his country and the feeble king. He was a priest, and a brave one. For 20 days, the Archbishop of Canterbury defended that city against its Danish besiegers, and when a traitor in the town threw the gates open and admitted them, he said, in chains, I will not buy my life with money that must be extorted from the suffering people. Do with me what you please. Again and again, he steadily refused to purchase his release with gold wrung from the poor. At last, the Danes being tired of this, and being assembled at a drunken merrymaking, had him brought into the feasting hall. Now, Bishop, they said, we want gold. He looked round on the crowd of angry faces, from the shaggy beards close to him, to the shaggy beards against the walls, where men were mounted on tables and forms to see him over the heads of others, and he knew that his time was come. I have no gold, he said. Get it, Bishop. They all thundered. That, I have often told you I will not, said he. They gathered close around him, threatening, but he stood unmoved. Then, one man struck him, then, another, then a cursing soldier picked up from a heap in a corner of the hall, where fragments had been rudely thrown at dinner, a great ox bone, and cast it at his face, from which the blood came spurting forth. Then, others ran to the same heap, and knocked him down with other bones, and bruised and battered him, until one soldier whom he had baptized, willing, as I hope for the sake of that soldier at Tiamat's soul, to shorten the sufferings of the good man, struck him dead with his battle axe. If Ethelred had had the heart to emulate the courage of this noble archbishop, he might have done something yet. But he paid the Danes £48,000, instead, and gained so little by the cowardly act, that Sweyn soon afterwards came over to subdue all England. So broken was the attachment of the English people, by this time, to their incapable king and their forlorn country which could not protect them, that they welcomed Sweyn on all sides, as a deliverer. London faithfully stood out, as long as the king was within its walls, but, when he sneaked away, it also welcomed the Dane. Then, all was over, and the king took refuge abroad with the Duke of Normandy, who had already given shelter to the king Otiam's wife, once the flower of that country, and to her children. Still, the English people, in spite of their sad sufferings, could not quite forget the great King Alfred and the Saxon race. When Sweyn died suddenly, in little more than a month after he had been proclaimed King of England, they generously sent to Ethelred, to say that they would have him for their king again, if he would only govern them better than he had governed them before. Atm the unready, instead of coming himself, sent Edward, one of his sons, to make promises for him. At last, he followed, and the English declared him king. The Danes declared Canute, the son of Sweyn, king. Thus, direful war began again, and lasted for 3 years, when the unready died. And I know of nothing better that he did, in all his reign of 38 years. Was Canute to be king now? Not over the Saxons, they said. They must have Edmund, one of the sons of the unready, who was surnamed Ironside, because of his strength and stature. Edmund and Canute thereupon fell to, and fought 5 battles. Oh, unhappy England, what a fighting ground it was! And then Ironside, who was a big man, proposed to Canute, who was a little man, that they two should fight it out in single combat. If Canute had been the big man, he would probably have said yes, but, being the little man, he decidedly said no. However, he declared that he was willing to divide the kingdom to take all that lay north of Watling Street, as the old Roman military road from Dover to Chester was called, and to give Ironside all that lay south of it. Most men being weary of so much bloodshed, this was done. But Canute soon became sole king of England, for Ironside died suddenly within 2 months. Some think that he was killed, and killed by Canute at Atm's orders. No one knows. Chapter of England under Canute the Dane. Canute reigned 18 years. He was a merciless king at first. After he had clasped the hands of the Saxon chiefs, in token of the sincerity with which he swore to be just and good to them in return for their acknowledging him, he denounced and slew many of them, as well as many relations of the late king. He who brings me the head of one of my enemies, Atm, he used to say, shall be dearer to me than a brother. Atm, and he was so severe in hunting down his enemies, that he must have got together a pretty large family of these dear brothers. He was strongly inclined to kill Edmund and Edward, 2 children, sons of poor Ironside, but, being afraid to do so in England, he sent them over to the King of Sweden, with a request that the king would be so good as to dispose of them. Atm, if the King of Sweden had been like many, many other men of that day, he would have had their innocent throats cut, but he was a kind man, and brought them up tenderly. Normandy ran much in Canute Atm's mind. In Normandy were the 2 children of the late King Edward and Alfred by name, and their uncle the Duke might one day claim the crown for them. But the Duke showed so little inclination to do so now, that he proposed to Canute to marry his sister, the widow of the unready, who, being but a showy flower, and caring for nothing so much as becoming a queen again, left her children and was wedded to him. Successful and triumphant, assisted by the valor of the English in his foreign wars, and with little strife to trouble him at home, Canute had a prosperous reign, and made many improvements. He was a poet and a musician. He grew sorry, as he grew older, for the blood he had shed at first, and went to Rome in a pilgrim Atm's dress, by way of washing it out. He gave a great deal of money to foreigners on his journey, but he took it from the English before he started. On the whole, However, he certainly became a far better man when he had no opposition to contend with, and was as great a king as England had known for some time. The old writers of history relate how that Canute was one day disgusted with his courtiers for their flattery, and how he caused his chair to be set on the seashore, and feigned to command the tide as it came up not to wet the edge of his robe, for the land was his. How the tide came up, of course, without regarding him, and how he then turned to his flatterers, and rebuked them, saying, "What was the might of any earthly king, to the might of the Creator, who could say unto the sea, 'Ay, thus far shalt thou go, and no farther?'" ATM We may learn from this, I think, that a little sense will go a long way in a king, and that courtiers are not easily cured of flattery, nor kings of a liking for it. If the courtiers of Canute had not known, long before, that the king was fond of flattery, they would have known better than to offer it in such large doses. And if they had not known that he was vain of this speech, anything but a wonderful speech it seems to me, if a good child had made it, they would not have been at such great pains to repeat it. I fancy I see them all on the seashore together, the king a TMS chair sinking in the sand, the king in a mighty good humor with his own wisdom, and the courtiers pretending to be quite stunned by it. It is not the sea alone that is bidden to go a thus far, and no farther. ATM The great command goes forth to all the kings upon the earth, and went to Canute in the year 1035, and stretched him dead upon his bed. Beside it, stood his Norman wife. Perhaps, as the king looked his last upon her, he, who had so often thought distrustfully of Normandy, long ago, thought once more of the two exiled princes in their uncle TMS court, and of the little favour they could feel for either Danes or Saxons, and of a rising cloud in Normandy that slowly moved towards England. Chapter VIII England under Harold Harfoot, Harder Canute, and Edward the Confessor. Canute left three sons, by name Swain, Harold, and Hardy Canute, but his queen, Emma, once the flower of Normandy, was the mother of only Hardy Canute. Canute had wished his dominions to be divided between the three, and had wished Harold to have England, but the Saxon people in the south of England, headed by a nobleman with great possessions, called the powerful Earl Godwin, who is said to have been originally a poor cowboy, opposed this, and desired to have, instead, either Hardy Canute, or one of the two exiled princes who were over in Normandy. It seemed so certain that there would be more bloodshed to settle this dispute, that many people left their homes, and took refuge in their woods and swamps. Happily, however, it was agreed to refer the whole question to a great meeting at Oxford, which decided that Harold should have all the country north of the Thames, with London for his capital city, and that Hardy Canute should have all the south. The quarrel was so arranged, and, as Hardy Canute was in Denmark troubling himself very little about anything but eating and getting drunk, his mother and Earl Godwin governed the south for him. They had hardly begun to do so, and the trembling people who had hidden themselves were scarcely at home again, when Edward, the elder of the two exiled princes, came over from Normandy with a few followers, to claim the English crown. His mother Emma, however, who only cared for her last son Hardy Canute, instead of assisting him, as he expected, opposed him so strongly with all her influence that he was very soon glad to get safely back. His brother Alfred was not so fortunate. Believing in an affectionate letter, written some time afterwards to him and his brother, in his mother a TMS name, but whether really with or without his mother a TMS knowledge is now uncertain, he allowed himself to be tempted over to England, with a good force of soldiers, and landing on the Kentish coast, and being met and welcomed by Earl Godwin, proceeded into Surrey, as far as the town of Guildford. Here, he and his men halted in the evening to rest, having still the Earl in their company, who had ordered lodgings and good cheer for them. But, in the dead of the night, when they were off their guard, being divided into small parties, sleeping soundly after a long march and a plentiful supper in different houses, they were set upon by the King of TMS troops, and taken prisoners. Next morning they were drawn out in a line, to the number of 600 men, and were barbarously tortured and killed, with the exception of every 10th man, who was sold into slavery. As to the wretched Prince Alfred, he was stripped naked, tied to a horse and sent away into the Isle of Ely, where his eyes were torn out of his head, and where in a few days he miserably died. I am not sure that the Earl had wilfully entrapped him, but I suspect it strongly. Harold was now king all over England, though it is doubtful whether the Archbishop of Canterbury, the greater part of the priests were Saxons, and not friendly to the Danes, ever consented to crown him. Crowned or uncrowned, with the Archbishop at Yarmouth sleeve or without it, he was king for 4 years, after which short reign he died, and was buried, having never done much in life but go a-hunting. He was such a fast runner at this, his favourite sport, that the people called him Harold Harfoot. Hardicanute was then at Bruges, in Flanders, plotting, with his mother, who had gone over there after the cruel murder of Prince Alfred, for the invasion of England. The Danes and Saxons, finding themselves without a king, and dreading new disputes, made common cause, and joined in inviting him to occupy the throne. He consented, and soon troubled them enough, for he brought over numbers of Danes, and taxed the people so insupportably to enrich those greedy favourites that there were many insurrections, especially one at Worcester, where the citizens rose and killed his tax collectors, in revenge for which he burned their city. He was a brutal king, whose first public act was to order the dead body of poor Harold Harfoot to be dug up, beheaded, and thrown into the river. His end was worthy of such a beginning. He fell down drunk, with a goblet of wine in his hand, at a wedding feast at Lambeth, given in honour of the marriage of his standard-bearer, a Dane named Tode the Proud. And he never spoke again. Edward, afterwards called by the monks the Confessor, succeeded, and his first act was to oblige his mother Emma, who had favoured him so little, to retire into the country, where she died some 10 years afterwards. He was the exiled prince whose brother Alfred had been so foully killed. He had been invited over from Normandy by Hardicanute, in the course of his short reign of 2 years, and had been handsomely treated at court. His cause was now favoured by the powerful Earl Godwin, and he was soon made king. This earl had been suspected by the people, ever since Prince Alfred at Yarmouth's cruel death. He had even been tried in the last train for the Prince at Yarmouth's murder, but had been pronounced not guilty, chiefly, as it was supposed, because of a present he had made to the swinish king, of a gilded ship with a figurehead of solid gold, and a crew of 80 splendidly armed men. It was his interest to help the new king with his power, if the new king would help him against the popular distrust and hatred. So they made a bargain. Edward the Confessor got the throne. The earl got more power and more land, and his daughter Edith Hull was made queen, for it was a part of their compact that the king should take her for his wife. But, although she was a gentle lady, in all things worthy to be beloved, a good, beautiful, sensible, and kinder, the king from the first neglected her. Her father and her 6 proud brothers, resenting this cold treatment, harassed the king greatly by exerting all their power to make him unpopular. Having lived so long in Normandy, he preferred the Normans to the English. He made Norman archbishop, and Norman bishops, his great officers and favourites were all Normans. He introduced the Norman fashions and the Norman language. In imitation of the state custom of Normandy, he attached a great seal to his state documents, instead of merely marking them, as the Saxon kings had done, with the sign of the cross, just as poor people who have never been taught to write, now make the same mark for their names. All this, the powerful Earl Godwin and his 6 proud sons represented to the people as disfavor shown towards the English, and thus they daily increased their own power, and daily diminished the power of the king. They were greatly helped by an event that occurred when he had reigned 8 years. Eustace, Earl of Boulogne, who had married the king at Yarmouth's sister, came to England on a visit. After staying at the court some time, he set forth, with his numerous train of attendants, to return home. They were to embark at Dover. Entering that peaceful town in armour, they took possession of the best houses, and noisily demanded to be lodged and entertained without payment. One of the bold men of Dover, who would not endure to have these domineering strangers jingling their heavy swords and iron corslets up and down his house, eating his meat and drinking his strong liquor, stood in his doorway and refused admission to the first armed man who came there. The armed man drew, and wounded him. The man of Dover struck the armed man dead.